I would like to introduce Dr. David Comito, who is here from Oregon. And he began practicing Zen in the mid-1960s and has been practicing Tibetan Buddhism since the early 80s. His doctorate is in Tibetan Buddhism. And his connection with us is through his teacher, Tara Tolku, who taught at Zen Center in the 80s. And that's a very modest introduction. So if you'd like to know more about him, I suggest you Google him.
I'm very honored to be seated here. This is a really venerable and very, very important temple in the Buddhist tradition in the United States. In fact, I feel terrified to be sitting here and speaking where so many extraordinary people have done so. But as was indicated, I've had feet in two traditions for quite a long time now. One foot in the Tibetan tradition, one foot in the Zen tradition, practicing in both. I lived at Green Gulch for about a year and a half, and off and on for shorter periods of time here. And I felt like it might be helpful to share some of my experience of having one foot in one tradition and one foot in the other tradition, and that maybe that binocular vision of things could prove useful to people. So that's what I'm going to try and do this evening. And I'm going to do it by talking about, at least initially talking about, the 29th case of the gateless gate. And I understand that there are people with many different levels of experience and study and longevity in the Zen tradition. So for those who know the story of the sixth Zen patriarch very well, indulge me when I share some of it. And for those that it's new, it would be very interesting. It's interested me throughout my life. That's why I come back to it over and over again. So the case, which is also a koan, is actually very simple. Two monks are in a courtyard. They see a flag that's flapping in the wind. One monk says, "It's the flag that's flapping." The other monk says, "No, it's the wind that's flapping. Wind is making the flag move." And they get into a real heated argument. Huineng walks up to them and says, "It's neither the wind nor the flag, it's your mind that's flapping." Their jaws drop, end of case. And you're supposed to contemplate that, and it produces whatever it produces in the way of meaning. Well, as it turns out, there's a whole story behind this. And as I learned quite some time ago, stories are really the way we understand things deeply. So I want to share some of this story with you, but as I said, I'll share it with you a bit from a Tibetan perspective, and that might bring a little additional meaning to this for those that are familiar with the story. If the meaning seems a little odd and out of character, then forget about it. If the meaning seems useful, then use it, and use it in your own practice. That's really what my intention is, that it would be helpful. So the story begins in the Tang Dynasty in China with a man who is presumably illiterate, Huineng, who becomes the sixth patriarch, who hears somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra and thinks, "Aha, I need to know more about this. Where did you learn about this? Where is this being taught?" And it's being taught in a certain monastery. And so Huineng determines to go to that monastery, which he does. Well, in those times, when you go to a monastery, the first thing that happens, perhaps it's similar to now, you meet the abbot, who maybe lets you in or maybe doesn't let you in. So the way the story goes is the abbot, now Huineng's telling this story, the abbot asked me, "Where are you from that you come to this mountain to make obeisance to me? Just what is it that you are looking for from me?" I replied, "I am from Lingnan, a commoner from Xinsu. I have come this long distance only to make obeisance to you. I am seeking no particular thing, but only the Buddha Dharma." The master then reproved me, saying, "If you're from Lingnan, then you're a barbarian. How can you become a Buddha?" I replied, "Although people from the south and people from the north differ, there is no north or south in Buddha nature. Although my barbarian's body and your body are not the same, what difference is there in our Buddha nature?" The master wished to continue his discussion with me. However, seeing that there were other people nearby, he said no more. Then he sent me to work with the assembly. Later, a lay disciple had me go to the threshing room, where I spent over 8 months treading the pestle. So the story begins with a key point, which is about Buddha mind or Buddha nature, which Huineng seems to understand from the very beginning. Nevertheless, he gets set to work threshing, which is to say separating the edible and unedible parts of rice for the assembly. And I take this to be a symbol. In the Tibetan tradition, which is inherited from India, there are what are called the five paths, which are developmental. And the first two paths are the paths of accumulation and preparation. In other words, developing the mind, developing good habits, accumulating merit is sometimes what's said. So I understand the meaning of this working in the kitchen, in the threshing room, working the mortar and pestle, actually, as he says, as his being on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation. He's developing his mind at this point. Now, these five paths were understood by the Chinese Buddhists of the time. This was not necessarily transferred to later Buddhism in China and Japan because of some persecutions in Tang Dynasty of the Buddhists by Confucians, and much of the scholarly apparatus was lost. But I'm quite sure that they understood this at the time. So my interpretation of this part of the story is he was beginning to develop his mind, and that's what is symbolic of his working in the kitchen. And for those of us who've worked in the kitchen, as I did in Green Gulch, it does train the mind, and we can train our minds by working in the kitchen. So, now, to continue the story, with a cup of tea first. Unexpectedly, one day, the fifth patriarch called his disciples to come. And when they had assembled, he said, "Let me preach to you. For people in this world, birth and death are vital matters. You disciples make offerings all day long and seek only the field of blessings, but you do not seek to escape from the bitter sea of birth and death. All of you, return to your rooms and look into yourselves. Men of wisdom will of themselves grasp the original nature of their prajna intuition." That's wisdom intuition. "Each of you write a verse and bring it to me. I will read your verses, and if there is one who is awakened to the cardinal meaning, I will give him the robe and the Dharma and make him the sixth patriarch. Hurry, hurry." The disciples received his instructions and returned, each to his own room. They talked it over among themselves, saying, "There's no point in our purifying our minds and making efforts to compose a verse to present to the priest. The head monk is our teacher. After he obtains the Dharma, we can rely on him. So let's not compose virtues." They're going to take the easy way out. Let the head monk do it, and we'll just be his disciples and not worry about it. However, for the head monk, he had other thoughts, because he wasn't so sure about his own virtue. He wasn't so sure what he knew. He wasn't so full of audacity about presenting a verse. So what he did was, at midnight, without letting anyone see him, he, the head student, went to write his mind verse on the central section of the south corridor wall where they were going to have a painting done, hoping to gain the Dharma. So in the middle of the night, he put the verse on the wall. And of course, he was thinking, if it's not any good, I'm not going to say that it's mine. And if it's good, I'm going to own up to it. So here's what his verse was. And this is very interesting. And I've loved this story for years. That's why I'm sharing it with you. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. At all times, we must strive to polish it and must not let the dust collect. In other words, keep your mind pure. Keep the dust off your mind. Practice so that there's clarity in your mind. Then he went back to his room. Next morning, the master comes out and looks at it. Okay. And then he calls all the disciples. He burns incense before the verse, and all the disciples were filled with admiration. The fifth patriarch said, "You should all recite this verse so that you'll be able to see into your own natures. With this practice, you will not fall into the three evil ways." Now, this is the key point. What's being said in this verse is that if you practice purification, if you work at accumulating merit, you will not fall into a lower rebirth, which was, of course, a great fear among Buddhists of the time. Many of us don't believe in rebirth, but we could say, if you purify your mind, if you practice, your life will improve. And if you don't do so, your life may not improve. And so there's good reason, even if you believe in only one lifetime, to go ahead in this way, to purify your mind through good works, as we might say in the Christian sense. So everyone's burning incense and they think this is wonderful. But the fifth patriarch calls a head student to his room and says, "This verse you wrote shows that you have still not reached true understanding. You have merely arrived at the front of the gate, but have yet to be able to enter it. If common people practice according to your verse, they will not fall, that is, into lower rebirths. But in seeking the ultimate enlightenment, or Bodhi, one will not succeed with such an understanding. You must enter the gate and see your own original nature." So in private, what he said to the head student is, "Nah, you still don't have it. This is very nice, but you still don't have it." And the head student goes back to his room and ponders this and doesn't really know what to do, because that's the limit of his understanding. He understands the way of merit. He understands the way of improving his mind by purifying his mind. But he doesn't really understand the teaching about his own Buddha nature, that it's right there within him. Hui Neng, however, does understand this. And the way of seeing directly into one's nature comes from him and comes from his teaching. Because, as we now read, he hears about this verse, because he's working in the kitchen. "As soon as I had heard it, I understood the cardinal meaning. I made a verse and asked someone who was able to write to put it on the wall of the west corridor so that I might offer my own original mind," because he's supposed to be illiterate, so of course he can't write either. "This is his verse. And for those that are familiar with the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, you'll recognize this kind of teaching. Bodhi originally has no tree. The mirror also has no stand. Buddha nature is always clean and pure. Where is there room for dust?" You're there already. Buddha nature is within you already. You just need to understand it and see into it directly through the practice of meditation. This should sound familiar. So that's what he's writing. That's what he's saying. Excuse me. At midnight, The fifth patriarch called me into the hall and expounded the Diamond Sutra to me. So what's happened here is the fifth patriarch understands that only Kuei Ning is somebody who would have understood this and could have written this, so he sends for him and calls him into his room. And he expounds the Diamond Sutra to him. And he says, Kuei Ning says, "Hearing it but once, I was immediately awakened, and that night I received the Dharma. None of the others knew anything about it. Then he transmitted to me the Dharma of sudden enlightenment and the robe, saying, 'I make you the sixth patriarch. The robe is the proof and is to be handed down from generation to generation.'" Now, in the tradition of describing the five paths, after the path of preparation and accumulation, there is a moment which is the path of direct seeing into emptiness, the true self, the true nature of ourselves. What I understand this encounter to mean is that the two of them met, and through the mind-to-mind transmission of the fifth to the sixth patriarch, suddenly Kuei Ning saw into the truth of things. It dawned. He saw emptiness. He saw his Buddha nature directly in that instant. Now, we would think that that's the end of the story, that that's all that's needed. But there are two more paths after this, because when you see into your nature, you still have all your old habit patterns. In fact, those habit patterns that were described when the head student was talking about cleaning the mirror, those old habit patterns still have to be removed, even though you've seen into your nature, according to this way of thinking. And the way I understand the next part of the story is the fifth patriarch says to Kuei Ning, who's now the sixth patriarch, leave this temple, work hard, take the Dharma with you to the south, where the barbarians are, by the way. For 3 years, do not spread the teaching, or else calamity will befall the Dharma. And I'm not sure what that means about calamity will befall the Dharma. But it seems to me that what he said to Kuei Ning is, now go out and continue to purify your mind based upon the deep understanding that you have of your own inner nature. And in doing this, what he's bringing together are the paths of purification and the path of insight into one's nature in this particular piece of the teaching. Now, the other way of looking at the relationship of this path of purification and the path of insight are what are called the two truths in Middle Way Buddhism. I'm not going to go into great detail about this because that would be like going down the rabbit hole. We can get lost in that forever. But for those of you who've studied Middle Way philosophy or Madhyamaka, it's my view that what the head student was writing about is what's called the conventional truth, the way of understanding how we live in the world. And what Kuei Ning was writing about was the ultimate truth of things, the true nature behind the appearances of the world. In the Tibetan tradition, this is described as what we experience when we're sitting on the meditation cushion and we deconstruct reality in our own minds to the point of seeing what's truly going on, and our experience off the meditation cushion, after deep meditation, when we have to engage the world. My favorite example is driving a car. If you were deeply into the experience of your own nature, deeply into the experience of emptiness, deeply into the experience of the fundamental non-difference between anything and anything, how could you possibly drive down Fell Street and get from one end to the other? I think it would be impossible. So in the tradition, you go back and forth between the deep experience of your inner nature while sitting on the meditation cushion, seeking for the ultimate in yourself, seeking for the ultimate truth, and the everyday experience of being off the meditation cushion, which Tibetans describe as illusion-like existence, dream-like existence. Not existence as a dream or an illusion, but illusion-like, being other than how it appears, and remembering that it's other than how it appears, but playing along with the game of appearances, because otherwise how are you going to get down Fell Street? It's just not going to work. Anyhow, that's my interpretation of what's going on here. So finally, after coming out of the path of seclusion, we get to the story of the flag. Because what's happened now is, to read the whole story, one day Hui Ning arrives in Nanhai at a certain temple that was headed by a Dharma master whose basic interest was in the Nirvana Sutra. And according to the story, it says, here he found shelter under the eaves of the temple. I mean, he wasn't even a monk in the temple. He was just sort of hanging out on the edge of the temple. One evening, when the wind was stirring the temple banner, he heard two monks arguing. One said that it was the flag that was moving, the other that it was the wind. Back and forth they argued, but were unable to realize the true principle. Hui Ning said, pardon a Karman layman for intruding into your lofty discussion, but it is neither the banner nor the wind that is moving. It is only your own mind that moves. So that's the case. And let me turn my attention to that for just a few minutes now. When you hear this case, when you hear the story, it sounds like these two monks must be complete idiots. How can they possibly be arguing about whether or not the wind is making the banner flap or the banner is flapping on its own? It's got to be obvious what's going on. Well, at this time in China, when there was going to be a Dharma talk, they would raise a flag outside of the monastery. So anybody who wanted to come to the Dharma talk could come to the Dharma talk. So there's something in the story that's pointing to something intellectual that's going on here, the Dharma talk, because that's what the flag symbolizes, by my way of thinking about it. And the position of the one monk, that the flag is moving on its own, is really an argument about what in Middle Way philosophy is called self-causation. And the argument that the wind makes the flag move in Middle Way philosophy is an argument for other causation. And what this means in brief, without going into a whole discourse on, say, Nagarjuna's thought, what this means in brief is the question is, what causes things? Is the cause of something within the thing itself, or is the cause of something outside of the thing? That means self-causation and other causation. My personal belief is that these were not two foolish monks, but these were two monks who were engaged in a very serious conversation about a middle way principle of causality. And they got really wrapped up in it, and they couldn't resolve it because, actually, as it turns out, it's an unresolvable question. Nagarjuna, who's somebody that I've spent years studying, works it over pretty well and basically says, there's no answer to that question. It's not one, it's not the other. And I think that that's what they were arguing about. But what Hui Ning has done is he's come into the situation and he's changed the entire discourse, because he said, it's neither the one or the other, it's your mind that's moving. It's your mind that's moving. Now, what does he mean when he says it's your mind that's moving? Well, remember, his enlightenment is connected with study of the Diamond Sutra, which is a perfection of wisdom sutra. And in the Diamond Sutra, there's considerable discussion about the nature of perception. And part of the way that that discussion goes is that when you see something, like I'm looking at this cushion, when you see something, what is happening is, literally, there's a perceptual process. The idea that something is objectively real is discounted by the sutra. And what the sutra indicates is that the appearance of the cushion is three things coming together. The sense organ of the eye, an object, a material object, and a moment of consciousness, and that what we take to be something is, if we analytically look at it, a perception that has those three elements. The same thing for anything else, any other kind of sense. A sound would be movement in the air, the ear, and consciousness. And the same with the mind. The mind would have an object, there's a moment of consciousness, it's a perception, it's a construct. My sense is that what Hui Ning has done is he shifted the argument entirely and said, no, the issue here is not self-causation or other causation. The issue here is it's your own mind at work, and recognize that what you think is something external is really your own mind at work, moving, constructing a world, and that you need to understand that your mind is constructing that world. And if you understand that, something will happen. He's utterly shifted the discourse. Now, there's an interpretation of the case where there's a story of a number of monks who are in an inn somewhere, and they're talking about this very unusual situation, this very unusual teaching. And they're getting into a heated discussion. And in the room next door, there's an elderly nun. And she says, you're a bunch of donkeys. It's not the wind that moves. It's not the flag that moves. It's not even the mind that moves. The point is for the mind to not move, which is to say that the point is to deeply understand, as it were, the space, if you will, or the Buddha nature, or the Buddha mind, in which all this movement is occurring, whether there's a movement of the mind, the movement of the wind, the movement of the flag, it doesn't make any difference at all. The essential point of this kind of practice of seeing into one's own nature, discovering oneself as a Buddha, is to get to the space behind all that stuff, what's called thus, that. An epithet for the Buddha is Tathagata, the thus gone, the one who has gone to thusness. And thusness is there within everybody. One just has to find it. One has to get to it. That's the point of meditation. They're all awakened, by the way, and they all become her disciples. And can you imagine the significance of this in Tang Dynasty China, that all these monks become disciples of this elderly nun? But according to the story, they do, because she's seen the truth, and they know it, and they get it. So, to summarize, I think the story is sharing with us the two aspects of our practice. On the cushion, seeing deeply into our nature, discovering our own Buddha natures, and finding peace in the process. And then, when we get off the cushion, and we have to drive the car down Fell Street, or we're taking care of our neighbors, or we're working in the kitchen, or whatever the case may be, we practice the purification of the mind. We practice compassionate action. We practice engagement with the world. But when we do that, we understand that the world is not what it appears to be, that it's a combination of something that is objectively there and our own minds wrapped up with it in such a way as it becomes very difficult and very complex to engage with it in the most wholesome way possible. And yet the attempt to do so, based upon what we've learned by sitting on the meditation cushion, about our own true nature, constantly is empowering, that the life on the cushion empowers action in the illusion-like world off the cushion. But interestingly, life in the illusion-like world off the cushion helps us with insight and purification into our own natures when we sit on the cushion, that the two come together. So my final thoughts on this. We can think of the illusion-like world as a place of difficulty, of challenge, of suffering, or we can imagine it as a field in which something else can happen, where we can bring ourselves to that field in an artful fashion, that we can create a life in the world which is in fact a work of art. Now, it perhaps is because I'm married to an artist that I tend to see things this way. But I think it's true that we can live in the world and make it a more beautiful place, a better place, by bringing our wisdom to it, by bringing our understanding of its transitory and transformable nature into everything we can do in the world. Now, when I came into the center the other day, I immediately saw some brochures about Buddhism and sustainability. And this is a very interesting topic, Buddhism and ecology, because we know what's going on in the world and we know what kind of problems we're facing. And they can be daunting. But at the same time, the practice of sustainability, the practice of transforming our world in a new kind of way, is this profoundly, deeply meritorious, possible field for artful action, because we can change it. We can bring our wisdom into this world. We can refresh ourselves on the cushion. We can bring our wisdom into this world, and we can make it a more beautiful and sustainable place. And I think that all these things are wrapped up in this story of the 29th case and the life of Huineng, the sixth patriarch. I think it's one of the reasons why for 40 years I've been fascinated with this story. Is that possible? I think 40 years I've been fascinated with this story. And the more I think about it, the more it enriches me. And good stories are like that. The more we think about them, the more they enrich us, and they reveal new aspects of themselves to us. So, here's a view of a Tibetan scholar about a Zen story about something that happened in the 7th century, but which I think is absolutely relevant to us now in the 21st century and can enrich us. As I said, if you find any of this useful, good. And if not, as the Dalai Lama says, forget about it. And thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure to share. It's been an honor. I'm very grateful. And I think I dedicate this to the memory of my Lama who taught here and brought me to this center, Tara Tulku. Thank you very much.